You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation. And it's lovely to see you all here this evening. The Aloud series is produced by the Library Foundation of LA, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. Aloud programs are made possible through member support. So thank you, all the members here in the audience this evening. And if you're not a member, please visit the membership table in the lobby or visit lfla.org to learn more about membership. I'd also like to invite you to the Stay at Home and Read a Book Ball, which is exactly as it sounds. And I'll be reading Erosion by Terry Tempest Williams. So please check out the Stay at Home Ball. Before introducing tonight's program, I want to talk about home, the theme for this year's programming. In a loose way, all of our programs will touch on this subject. We're not trying to answer the question of what is home, but rather proposing ideas that will hopefully make each of us think more deeply about the concept and how it resonates with us. We'll be exploring some topics that seem on the surface to have nothing to do with home, but in some tangential way, there is a very clear connection. Other subjects will be more obvious. Here are a few things we'll be covering: our constitution, family, food, shelter, our mental health, and the natural world. Tonight's program ties back to our theme of the powerful stories of Callie Fajardo Anstine, which covers mothers, daughters, and friends, and the truths about their connections to their homeland. We're so happy to be in partnership with the National Book Foundation and Scripps College to showcase this new, talented voice. I'd like to introduce the innovative and inspiring executive director of the National Book Foundation, Lisa Lucas. Please welcome Lisa Lucas. Thank you.
Hello. How are you all doing? Yay. Okay, so I'm Lisa. And I'm excited to welcome you to the second of two programs that we've done this week in California, in partnership with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and Scripps College, that will be celebrating National Book Award honored authors and their work. So big thanks to Jessica Strand, Miranda King, Jorge Martinez, Kelsey McRae, and everybody at the library, and also Natalie Green at the National Book Foundation, who works super hard on all of these programs. Fair enough. Let's just be real clappy. So before we get started, I just want to talk a little bit about the National Book Foundation. So since 1950, we've done the National Book Awards, which I'm assuming you all know about, so I'm not going to explain. But the foundation actually exists not only to celebrate the best literature in America, but also to widen its audience and to make sure that books remain culturally relevant. And we do that through a series of year-round programs designed to bring people into literature. So we do educational programs, we do public programs. And in LA alone, we've donated books to children and families living in public housing through our Book Rich Environments program. We have an after-school reading group for middle schoolers with Book Up at Fauché Learning Academy. We launched our Literature for Justice program, which is actually something that identifies books that we think everyone should read about mass incarceration. We launched it right here in this room last year. And we're really happy to be here again with NBF Presents, which brings National Book Award authors to libraries, colleges, book festivals, and presenting houses, and is supported by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, to whom we are exceedingly grateful. Since 2018, we've met over 10,000 audience members. We've donated over 1 million books to public housing, and we've been to 39 states. Next year, we will hit all 50, and we can sleep. Everyone in my office will kill me if I don't invite you to sign up for our newsletter, which should be outside. And we're always in LA. We like it here. It's our second home. And so hopefully we'll have lots more for you all to do. So now that's enough of my song and dance. So sorry. But tonight's conversation features National Book Award finalist Callie Fajardo Anstine. Sadly, Erica L. Sanchez was unable to join us. She's not well, so I'm so sorry. I hope you guys got the Eventbrite email. But we will have the pleasure of hearing from Callie about her work and debut collections, Sabrina and Karina, and why presenting the experience of Mexican-American and Indigenous women in literature matters. I'll introduce Callie, who will read, and then we'll chat, and then we'll open up for a few questions from the audience. following the program, though, Kali will be signing books. And so now I'm excited to introduce her. Kali Fajardo-Anstein is the author of Sabrina and Karina, a 2019 finalist for the National Book Award in Fiction Story Prize and a finalist for the Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for Debut Short Story Collections. She's the 2019 recipient of the Denver Mayor's Award for Global Impact in the Arts. Her fiction has appeared in The American Scholar, Bellevue Literary Review, Southwestern American Literature, and elsewhere. She has been awarded fellowships from Yaddo, McDowell, and Hedgebrook. She has an MFA from the University of Wyoming and is from Denver, Colorado. So welcome, Kali, to the stage.
Hi, guys. Okay, this is not on. Hello, is it on? Okay, hey, guys. I am so excited to be here. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, the Library Foundation. This is my second visit to Los Angeles with Sabrina and Karina, and the first time was with the Yosemar Reyes Book Club, so I am deeply honored to be back. I'm going to read a little bit from the title story, Sabrina and Karina. And if any of you have a book with you, I'm going to be reading from page 33 on. And I don't really give very much context for what I read, but if you'd like some context, Sabrina and Karina, the narrator of this story is Karina. She's a makeup artist at Macy's, and her best friend, her closest cousin, Sabrina, has been murdered at the start of the story. And Karina has been asked by the family if she'll do the makeup for the funeral on Sabrina's body. We were inseparable in high school. Sabrina was my best friend, my closest cousin. My father would give me a hard time, ask if I ever tired of carrying her dead weight. But Sabrina was fun. She was vivid and felt everything deeply. From the heartbreak to the drunken nights, we stayed up until 4 o'clock in the morning, mapping out our tiny lives with enormity only Sabrina could imagine. To her, everything was possible. Money, true love, a way out of Colorado. Even after she dropped out in 11th grade to work at a sports bar downtown, I used to do homework in a back booth, marveling at the way she glided between tables, sleek and fluid with her long black hair curled around her elegant neck. Men would follow her between their bites of onion rings and beer-battered fish, insatiable, as if my cousin were just another symptom of their hunger. After graduation, my father offered to pay for cosmetology school. He said that I needed to do something besides run around like other Cordova women. He mostly met Sabrina, of course, who by that point had started showing up to family dinners smelling like a barroom floor. But it wasn't just her. There was the distant niece whose infant son was taken away by the state, the cousins who died messing around with heroin, great Auntie Dodie left blind after a date with the wrong man, and Auntie Liz found dead in her Chrysler, the motor running, the garage door locked. My grandmother hardly mentioned Auntie Liz, except to say what had killed her had killed them all. While I was studying cuts and colors, perms and relaxers, Sabrina continued working in bars and sleeping with men who all looked alike. Tall, thick-necked, green eyes or blue. In my mind, these men formed a lineup of indifferent masculine faces, a continuation of the withdrawn expression I had seen in those old photographs of Sabrina's father. Sometimes she'd visit me at the beauty college. She would stand at my station in wrinkled clothes, looking like she'd just woken up at noon. While the other girls snickered and popped their gum, Sabrina would scoop away her hair, and I'd see the bruises, hickeys like rotten goose eggs down her throat. "They'll send me home from work," she'd say, and I always helped her conceal everything. After finishing beauty school, I rented a studio apartment on the west side that overlooked an abandoned public pool. At night, on my second floor balcony, I'd sit and wonder about the missing diving board, replaced with an orange traffic cone, as if that could stop someone from leaping headlong into orange cement. It was a lonely place, and Sabrina only visited during the rare times when she was single. She'd come over and shadow me throughout the apartment, like a child who was afraid she'd stop existing if someone wasn't there to see her. "You ever do makeovers on women who look hideous without makeup?" she asked. She was sitting on the lid of my toilet with two Coronas between her thighs, one for each of us. We had the radio on an oldie station, the type of music our mothers played when we were little girls, and they would drive us through the mountains in the summertime. "Sure," I said, smiling. "But after I fix them up, nobody can tell." "I guess only they can," Sabrina said, and she checked her reflection in the mirror, smudging her berry lip liner with her left pinky. "And of course, you." We went to a bar that night, on the edge of the city, near a highway overpass. Neon signs hung in the foggy windows. We played a couple games of pool and drank shots of cheap tequila, and every now and then, Sabrina danced over to the old school jukebox and flipped through the records, the light flickering over her face, her reflection a floating bust on the glass. I sat at the bar and watched a group of men circle around her. They held their beers close to their chest, and they waited for an opportunity to move in like vultures. "We're going outside for a cigarette," Sabrina said. Two pale-faced guys with those broad shoulders and thick necks stood behind her, nervously casting glances my way, as if afraid I'd ruin their fun. "But you don't smoke," I said. "I picked it up," Sabrina said, "just now." I watched the front window as she stepped outside and she flopped against a parked minivan, twisting her hair around her fingers, her smile all teeth. The men stood next to her packing their smokes. Neither was in her league. But Sabrina had a way of talking to men like she was a gift, an offering of an expressive pretty face and a girlish giggle. It didn't matter who it was, so long as she gave her attention back. After a while, I couldn't watch her anymore. I swiveled around on my stool and I tried to catch the bartender's attention. He eventually came by, a white washcloth over his shoulder. "That your sister?" he asked, glancing out the window. "Not my sister," I said, and I looked at Sabrina, tossing her hair back, the cords of her neck forming a chute to her collarbones. "My cousin." "I knew you two were related." He poured tequila and set it before me. "You look similar." "Not really," I said, and swallowed my shot. When Sabrina hobbled back inside, she could hardly stand in wedge platforms. The men guided her by her wrist, and she swayed between them until they released their grips, and Sabrina leaned over me, her perfume gone rancid with hints of rotten fruit, something that belongs in the trash. "Karina, Karina," she asked, "having fun?" I glared at the two guys beside her. They were far less drunk than my cousin, and beaming with pride, as if they had already gotten her into a cab and headed for one of their apartments. "Let's go," I said. Sabrina squinted at me. Tiny wrinkles had begun to form around her eyes and lips. "You can leave me here," she said. "I'll get home okay." With my hands firmly around her wrist, I towed her to the front door. The two men laughed, backed off, and began to circle another girl a few stools down. The bartender pulled the white washcloth over the bar, eyeing the two of us while we left with what I thought was pity. "Let's go!" I was gripping Sabrina's wrist harder than necessary. She wobbled behind me, and I squeezed tighter, angrier, worried my nails would mark her skin. "Don't you care how people look at you?" Outside, the air was cool, the moon surrounded by a thin cloud. I kept dragging Sabrina to the car as she tottered behind me, her face to the sky like that of a dreamy child. And when I finally let her go, she steadied herself against my trunk, opening her blue eyes wide. "They look at us the same way, Karina," she laughed and pointed at my face. "They look at us like we're nothing." I told her to get into my car, and I said that she was drunk. And as we drove home, I glanced at her worn-out face resting against the window, and I felt something unknowable about Sabrina, some sadness at her core that moved between us like a sickness. Where did it come from? Or had it always been there, growing inside her, filling her lungs with its liquid weight? "Sabrina," I whispered, tapping her shoulder. But she was already asleep, and for the first time in my life, I miss someone sitting right beside me. Thank you. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. Hi. I feel like you're so happy, and then you read this like very tough story, and then you're like, hey. which is so interesting, which is like there's layers, right? Yeah. So tell me about Denver. and you're Denver.
Yeah.
Which is where all these stories are
all set. Yeah. So I'm from Denver, and but I'm actually like I'm so deeply part of Colorado. So my ancestors migrated north from southern Colorado, which at one point had been Mexico before 1848, and they came up to Denver in the 1930s. And we started wildly mixing Filipino and Jewish blood and all this like crazy, cool, wonderful, beautiful things that was happening in Denver. But I never saw us in the official state history, in the archives. I never saw us in books. I didn't see us on television, nowhere. So while I lived this robust, wonderful life in Denver, it was this strange experience of just not seeing yourself reflected by the state. So my Denver, it was just, it was always there, and it was so vibrant and alive, and then I would go to school, and they'd say, oh, the way we got here is that white people came from the east, and they pushed over, and, like, here we are, and I was always very confused, because I was like, that's not the story that I was told. Right. So, yeah, my Denver, it's a different place, and I wanted to share it. I wanted to show the world what we are.
Right, and so this book, I feel like once it gets out into the world and people start reading it and reviewing it and passing it around, it starts to take on its own story. This is a book about. This is a book about. What do you think that this book is about?
I think that this is a book about women. I think this is a book about Chicanas. I think this is a book about mixed people. And I think this is a book about depression and resiliency and addiction and what it means to come from generational trauma.
Right.
But I also think that this is a book about family and love and sisterhood and taking care of each other and what it means to be part of a community and to be part of a people that have a homeland. Like, we are from here, from here, from here. And I wanted that heartbeat to show up in Sabrina and Karina.
Right. So I feel like I was reading Toni Cade Bambara recently. And there's, like, the opening, the preface is, like, about, like, how it doesn't make sense to make fiction about your family, which is not to say that your fiction is about your family. But just, but even that wider sense, like, the community that you're from, right? This is one of the first representations of the community that you are from that is explicitly, like, about Colorado, about Chicano women, you know? And so it's like, did that give you any sense of responsibility to tell positive stories or to tell real stories or to, you know, shy away from, like, family business?
Yeah.
You know, I feel like sometimes you have, like, community issues and it's like, well, don't write a book about that because then they're going to think that we're this way or that way.
Yeah. So, like, when I first started writing these stories, I did not think I would ever be able to get published because I didn't have any models that would show me that could happen. So I was just sort of obsessively writing and hoping. I mean, that was my dream. I wanted to be a famous writer since I was a baby, but I didn't think it was going to happen. So I just was writing whatever I felt compelled to write, like what was sticking with me that I was obsessed with, that I couldn't get rid of it. But it was sort of funny. So I was working on these stories, and I remember one of my first published stories, Any Further West, which is set here in California. It appeared in the Boston Review. And right before it was published, my father had read a draft, and he told me, you can never show your mother this story. And I was like, well, it's about to be published, so, like, she's going to see it somehow. And then my mom read it, and instead of being upset, she said, how did you know what it was like for me and my mom growing up? And so it actually was allowing her to heal some of her generational wounds, too. And I think that there is incredible pressure to try to, like, sugarcoat things and not reveal. But I'm not really interested in art that's not honest. And I think that the way that you can touch people and change their lives is to be as honest and full as possible with those intentions.
Right. Is there anything that was particularly hard in this collection to tell? Any stories that were particularly hard to write or that you had felt sensitive about?
Yeah, there's a couple. Sisters is the only story in the book that's set in the past. It's set in the 1950s. And Sisters is based on the life of my Auntie Dodie, who was my great-grandmother's sister. And my Auntie Dodie was blinded by a white man. And that was just a story I was told over and over again about this act of great violence in the family. And I never expected that I would write about it. I remember I was living in Laramie, Wyoming. I was going to graduate school up there. And I was living in this, like, 1890s, like, hotel. And one day, this voice just started coming through me while I was sitting there in my apartment alone. And I was like, this is Auntie Dodie. And I made a voice recording. And when I played it back, I got scared because it didn't sound like my cadence. So that story, I did have some difficulties when it was time to publish this book, there was some pushback because it's so violent. And I had to come up with reasons why is it important to look at this violence head on, mm-hmm. especially when women from my background and my community have not had justice for so many generations. There's been so much injustice. And I think that one of the ways that I can honor their lives is just tell what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And then another story that was sort of difficult is Cheeseman Park. Mm-hmm. Again, like I've borrowed a lot from my own life in some of these stories, and a lot of the stories that deal with violence against women or domestic abuse, those are things that I'm open about that I grew up with in some ways. So it's difficult to have to put yourself out there. And while I'm working on new work, I have noticed that I'm a little bit scared to put myself on the page as much as I did when I was working on this book because I didn't have an audience back then.
Right. And so now that it's like obviously all fiction and all writing is written to be, you know, in conversation with the person who's reading it. But now that you know who's reading it, right? It's not like an imagined, projected, like, so one, I guess, who do you feel like your audience is? Or who did you think it was going to be? And who is it now?
Yeah, so I always thought that I was writing for myself when I was younger. Mm-hmm. This Chicana who was super mixed, who grew up like somewhat in the city but somewhat in the suburbs, and she just felt really alone and really ashamed and really isolated. And I was like, that girl needs a book, and I thought I was writing for her. And then it turned out that there were a lot of people like me, mm-hmm. and people were saying, I've never felt fully represented. I've never seen myself in a story where we're just allowed to be people. We're not attached to these other societal issues, like. I just wanted to be a person in a story. But now, since the National Book Award finalist spot, which is very exciting, the book has gone out to a wider audience. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'm getting a lot of feedback from people who are not part of my culture necessarily. Right. And one of the main critiques I get from people usually outside is that the book is so sad. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, well, I think there's beauty in sadness sometimes. Right. So I have to be like, well, that's a cultural thing, you know. So there is there's a lot of cultural translation in some ways that I didn't expect to happen.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I guess what did you grow up reading?
Yeah.
Right. Like, what were you reading in this like vacuum of not having things that were like.
Yeah.
About you.
So I love books, and like this is something that I find interesting because I grew up reading like Harry Potter and the Chronicles of Narnia, and like mm-hmm. I'm not Harry Potter, but I felt like I was Harry Potter. Right. But there's just a different level of comfort when you can see yourself.
Right.
Like I was reading Erica's book, and while I was reading that, I was getting tripped up on whether or not some of her scenes were my own memories.
Right.
And that's just a feeling I never had growing mm-hmm. up reading books. And I was like, do white people feel like their memories are like coming through them in books? And I was like, what? So it was like a whole brand new world was opening up for me when that happened. Right. But yeah, I read The Giver. I really was into that. And I loved everything. But I think it was not enough to just read after a while. I wanted to participate. Right. I wanted to give books out too.
Right. So just to Erica's book, and obviously she's supposed to be here and I'm very sad she isn't, but these are two extraordinarily different books. But since we both read them and we're going to talk about them,
yeah.
I mean, you find yourself in that book, but these are two totally different. I mean, you want to talk a little bit about Erica's book
yeah.
and like the differences between your book.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting.
Yeah. And I think like that's, so, like, when I was growing up in literature classes, mm-hmm. we were given, like, two books by Latinas. And it was House on Mango Street, which changed my life, and I loved it. And I actually, that was it. That's all we were given.
So it was the one book. I was given the same book.
Yeah, okay. I was like, okay. But, like, I had to, like, really, like, kind of squint to see my reality in that book mm-hmm. because my family has been in Colorado since the records go back to the pueblos of northern New Mexico. So it's a very different experience. But I was like, hey, whatever. Like, I'll see myself in this too. And then when I was reading Erica's book, I was like, I've never seen anything like this, where it's second generation and the parents crossed over. And I was like, this is so cool. And she's punk rock and she's into indie music. And I was really emo. still a little emo. But I think that's what's so awesome about if we can keep building more and more stories, that there can just be this robust, you know, this robust family of Latinx literature, and we don't have to pick a story that doesn't really necessarily resemble our own lives.
Right.
We can just start contributing, and there'll be so many to choose from.
Right.
One of my favorite notes—oh, thank you, guys. One of my favorite notes I've ever gotten from a reader, they sent me a direct message on Instagram, and they said, your book is the first book I read about Latinos that does not resemble my family. And mm-hmm. I was like, yeah!
Right, which is really exciting. Like, I feel like, you know, just Black literature, it's like, it is not one way.
Yeah.
Right? It is, like, not a monolith. And so I think it's really interesting to see sort of how literature is progressing. I think it's a lot better now, although it's still...
It's pretty bad,
you know,
still,
yeah.
But...
Let's I mean, there's not the
up.
One book. We have at least the three books
we have three
that we've
now.
Mentioned today.
We have three. Yeah. I did an interview the other day, and somebody said, it's gotten so much better. There's all these books by writers of color on. I was like, yeah, compared to the hundreds upon hundreds and thousands that are published by, yeah.
Right. You know, and that, right. No, there's a lot. But so in the books that you were reading growing up, you like found yourself inside of,
yeah.
Like, same here. You know, it's like you're reading a book and you're like, I have no relationship to Little Women.
Yeah.
And yet I'm like, I have. You know, a strong will, yeah. And maybe I'm Joe.
Maybe.
In a wig, you know.
Like, yeah.
If we move it 50 years into the future, you know, maybe. But do you think that readers, that white readers, can find themselves in your book? And if so, how?
Yeah, well, they better be able to, because that's what great literature does. You should be able to find yourself in any book.
Mm-hmm.
Does not matter. I mean, but I think that the way that you can find yourself in a book like mine or any book if you're not from that group is
right.
Just what does it mean to be human?
Right.
So people ask me sometimes, like, what themes do you like to write about? And I quote Faulkner, and it, like, really freaks them out. like, so when Faulkner was awarded the Nobel Prize, he gave this acceptance speech, and he says that we should write about love, honor, pity, and pride.
Mm-hmm.
And when people ask me what I wrote about, I say love, honor, pity, and pride, and compassion, and sacrifice, like Faulkner said, we should be writing about. And they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, because basically human beings are human beings. From all over the world, we share these certain similarities. And so that's how hopefully people are able to find themselves in these characters.
Right.
It even goes across gender, because all of these stories are about women.
Right.
And so I'll have male readers come up and say, I can't believe I felt what those women were feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yeah, because we're humans. Imagine.
So you focused on women. You know, that's in every story. You know, you have these incredible women that are, their stories are being told. Why, you know, if you are writing about a place that is not often written about and about a community that is not often written about, do you pick one particular segment of it? Did you not feel the desire to sort of be like, I want to make a bigger world and I need to focus on men and I need to focus on, you know, like, how do you resist sort of trying to use an even bigger canvas?
Yeah.
And why did you decide to sort of narrow it? Because it feels tight, right? Like, it's like the fact that you focused, I mean, part of the reason why it's such a strong collection is because it feels focused. All the stories are different, you know,
yeah.
But there is a real love of the relationships between women beyond even just women in general. I mean, you have sisters, you have mothers and daughters, you know, it's like, it's always about the interchange.
Yeah. Yeah. So the basic answer is I didn't really think about it
mm-hmm.
when I was working on the story. It didn't occur to me, like, why don't you have any male protagonists? And I was like, I think the truth is I come from a family of seven children and six of us are girls.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of girls to grow up with. And the story keepers in my family were women. So the elders that were controlling the narrative of what it meant to be a person and alive in the world were always older women.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't something I wasn't studying masculinity in the same way I think I was studying girlhood and then womanhood. I'm working on a new short story right now. I have my novel. I'm working on edits with that. There, it's about women.
Right.
I'm still interested in us.
Right.
I know that Toni Morrison, like, what was it, like, book three, she was like, I'm going to explore men or something in Song mm-hmm. of Solomon. But it's like, maybe I will start exploring the lives of men. But
you
right
don't
now,
need to.
Right now. Like, I don't know.
We're good. We're grateful for it.
Thank you.
They've had their centuries.
Yeah. Thank you. Let me have these few months, okay?
Right. Let's just get 2020, 2021.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
But also, this is a book about, you know, not just Mexican folks, right? This is about indigenous folks,
yeah.
right? And so can you talk about, like, I mean, what is our perception culturally yeah. of what a Mexican-American person is, and what is the reality of what your community is? Because I think that there's probably not the same, if somebody's just sort of glancing at it, you yeah. know, they're not even going to necessarily see the word indigenous, you know? It's yeah. like, because you already have this very clear perception of who we're going to be hearing about.
Yeah, so this, it's, so basically we're not all the same. So I think that that's been one of the issues with publishing for so long, is that Latinx literature was all under one umbrella, and it's like this enormous monolith that somehow mm-hmm. encapsulates like this enormous section of the world. But that's why I think it was really difficult for me to find books that sort of resembled my background. And that is, there's a lot of Chicanos like me from Texas, California, mm-hmm. you know, New Mexico, Arizona. Mm-hmm. But these are families that have been here since pre-statehood.
Right.
You know, families that before that were mixed indigenous people. And my family, they were Picaris Pueblo. My aunt, right. like, so essentially, what was happening is that for generations, there was this form of forced assimilation happening, and it was a violent form of forced assimilation. And that's where a lot of my family stories come from, what it meant to go out into the white world and have your languages stripped of you, mm-hmm. and not just Spanish, because my great-grandmother also grew up speaking indigenous languages.
Right.
So to have your languages stripped of you, to not be able to live where you want to live in the city, all these things, all this kind of violence over and over again, and that's a very specific experience that I thought, it just felt like very, like, looked over.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people in my community that they're still trying to achieve whiteness. You know, they get to this level of mixing, and all of a sudden they're just white people. And, you know, if you take an indigenous group of people and you force them over generations to assimilate and to mix out, you essentially kill off that group of people.
Right.
And it's just a slower process. So I want to be able to look at that and say, hey, this is still part of that, this enormous genocide that happened on this continent.
Right.
And I know that's sort of controversial, but it's important to look at, like, there are indigenous people who are mixed Latinos that are living in the United States, and it's not like it. We just always have been there, and
right.
we're not disappearing. And I think we should be talked about. I think our indigeneity needs to be talked about more.
Right. And so what does that mean? I mean, you're talking about sort of just like even just on a practical level, right? Like assimilation on a, this is what I'm going to wear today, or how I'm going to speak, or who I'm going to hang out with, or who I'm going to make, like whatever, those, all the various ways that we do it. But also you have, right, in the canon, right, and a total erasure.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and what does that mean for us culturally? To sort of not only on a practical level, like what I do on Tuesday, but also to have sort of like representations in art and in literature and in music and in film, to have that absence. Like, what does it mean? And what does it mean now? What's the significance yeah. of starting to have that conversation?
I think, like, that question is so serious to me, because I think it speaks to a sickness on the part of who did the erasure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it feels like there's some illness in the soul of our humanities if there's no reflection of the true depth of our human experience. And so I don't know how to answer that question, but mm-hmm. I do know that, like, those who did the erasure need to really look at themselves and ask, why did we do this? Like, why did we keep one group of people or multiple groups of people from being able to see themselves reflected in art and literature and music and everything else? And it's not that we were not making those things. It's just we weren't being elevated at that same level and then pushed out into the culture on that same stage.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it, like I said, like when I was reading Erica's book, it's like, this feels so great, like to have this in my psyche.
Right.
And so I think when you're erased, it does something, it's trauma. I mean, it's another form of trauma to just not have anything reflected back to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's serious, it needs to be fixed.
Yeah. And so what's the burden of representation then when you do that work? Like, you know, when you're trying to translate people's voices, the food, the, you
yeah.
know, like the problems, the assimilation, you know, how do you try to capture those things? Like, did you spend time sort of researching? Like, even obviously
yeah.
these are characters that are like living daily lives, but how
yeah.
did you go about trying to accurately represent?
Well, I think for a lot of writers, I'm very observant. So I grew up and I paid attention. And
mm-hmm.
when people ask for advice, like, how do I become a better writer? I said, just start, you know, taking notes of the things that you're around. And that starts to train you to become a researcher. But yeah, so I grew up and I was living these experiences, cooking, talking to my family, all that. But then when I started writing stories that were set in the past, specifically sisters, I needed to do research. Mm. And that's when I went and I started looking in the official archives and I realized we weren't there. Mm. And so that caused like a whole nother layer of just anger on my part. But then I've also started the process now of trying to donate family collections to the official state archives so I can just get more of us in there. But yeah, so for the novel that will be coming out after Sabrina and Karina, that I've done extensive research, and mm-hmm. that's anything from interviewing elders in my own family, finding oral histories from other families. Mm-hmm. I drive all over the Southwest. I visit clothing shops so I can look at vintage clothes, right. Wedding dresses, sewing patterns, newspaper clips. I can go on and on. Yeah. I mean, I love it because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to populate the world of my ancestors and bring them back out because they were never allowed
right.
that life.
Right, right. And so this to me, like, right, like I feel like if somebody pitched me this book,
yeah,
I would be like, absolutely. Like, cool. Right? Like, you know, this is a story that needs to be told. What was the journey of this book?
Yeah, that's not what happened. I wish you had been on the other side of those
yeah,
desks.
Yeah, I would have been all about it.
So, like, long story short, I'm a big dropper-outer. So I dropped out of high school. I have a GED. And then I went to State College in Denver. I went to Metro State. And from there, it was like my last semester of school, and one of my professors said, hey, you know, you're pretty good and you're really interested in short stories. Have you ever thought about getting an MFA? And I said, what's that? Like, I had no idea what that was. And so it's a master's program in creative writing. And so I was like, I had no idea how these official channels worked, and I just applied to all the top schools, and mm-hmm. I sat back, and I spent all this money, and then I got accepted to none. And then one school took pity upon me, I think, but they let me in California, and I did not. It was a very bad cultural fit. It was the first time I had ever left my family, and I was living alone in California, and I was going through a lot of deep depression at the time, which is something I've struggled with my entire life. And that's when I first started writing these stories, though. Mm-hmm. So that's when I started Any Further West, and I started Remedies there. Well, I dropped out because there was an incident, and I reapplied. And I thought, okay, now I know what these programs are.
Right.
I wasted this whole time, but now I know what a master's program is. And I went to the University of Wyoming. And I thought, this would be a great fit. It's the Rocky Mountains. It's to the west. It's where I'm from. And then I got there, and I was the only Chicana in my program. And all the other students were writing great American West literature, and they were white men. And their stories are about, like, fly fishing and hunting. And I was like, cool. Okay, well, I'm also writing about the American West. And so I just started busting out these stories. And I think in some ways I was like, hey, you want to write about the American West? I'm actually going to do it from this space. And then I got a book deal, no. And then and then I would send them out to magazines, and I would get, there's hundreds of rejections in my email, hundreds. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not exaggerating. And it just, I had one agent, and she dumped me, and it was 7 years.
7 years?
7 years.
7 years?
Yeah.
I don't think I actually knew that. I knew that you were going to be like, yeah. I didn't just immediately get lucky, and like my book, I wouldn't have asked the question if it had been like really straightforward. But 7 years?
Yeah. So there was a lot of breakdowns along the way where I thought, I'm going to have to give up.
Like, did you call these people back after the National Book Award finalists?
Well, now they call me back. And now I'm like, I'm sorry, I can't visit. No, I mean, it was pretty rough. And I had to write a whole novel in order to get this book picked up, which mm-hmm. is fine because now I have a book, like another right. book. Which probably would, you guys have been waiting like 15 more years if I hadn't had that next book ready to go. But yeah, it was a big struggle, and a lot of the comments I would, like, first of all, I would just get form rejections, but some of them, they would write back and they'd say, can you make this more exotic? They wouldn't use that word, oh my God, but they probably did. But I would be asked to put in more food references, put in more Spanish when I can't speak Spanish. Like just things that did not make any sense. And I got some comments that all the stories are exactly alike.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, when? Like, how? So yeah, it was just, it was a long fight. And it didn't, even when the book came out, it felt kind of hopeless at times. But there were always, you know, this groundswell. There were always people, like, from my own communities that were pushing it and bringing it up. And then National Book
right.
Awards.
And now you're in a place, right, where there's, like, the Penn, Robert Bingham Prize, finalist, Story yeah. Prize.
Yeah.
Right? There's all these things happening.
Yeah.
Right? And it's the same book.
Yeah, weird.
What do you think that says about the audience for this book? I mean, beyond sort of like a young woman who might pick the book up and be like, I see myself here.
Yeah.
But the critical audience, you know, what do you think that they're now seeing that they missed before?
Thank you. I'm wondering if there's a disconnect between, there's one layer where there's the critical layer over here. That's where the awards, everything exists. And then there's the media and the publicity machine over here in the middle. And then there's the writers on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if this middle section has not been diversified as much as the critical side.
Right.
So I don't know. Because the fact that this book has been nominated for so many awards, I'm still stunned every day mm-hmm. of my life. And I'm not stunned because I don't think I wrote a great book. But I am stunned. I am stunned because the kinds of writers who are now able to judge.
Right.
So as, like, that's what I'm most excited about, I think, with getting these award nominations. I'm going to be able to judge eventually. And I'm going to be able to pick books and push those on. And I think as more of us come to the table, you're going to see literature diversify.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think there's an element of contagion to it, too. Right? Like, it's like, I think some people, and now this is a comment and not a question. So I'm going to stop since none of you guys are going to ask any of those, right? It does seem contagious, though. So in terms of, you know, how long did these stories take you to write, like on a like sort of technical side?
Yeah.
Like, as you were writing them, you know, what's your process?
Sure. So I'm working on a story right now, which is like the most painful story I've ever written. And I'm realizing that some of these babies came out way easier. Like mm-hmm. my sister just gave birth last week and she was like, oh, it was so easy. And I was like, that's one of your easy stories or easy babies. So Sugar Babies, the very first story in the collection, that came to me in one weekend. I whipped it out and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm a genius. All her names, I had to go through so many drafts of that. And I'm not talking like every 2 weeks I'd fix something. I'm talking about like 3 years
yeah.
of drafting. But my process normally looks like this. I write a draft. I try to power through a whole draft so you can just see what you have.
Right.
And then you have to go through and you have to analyze, what is my unconscious even doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kinds of themes are showing up? What kinds of imagery are showing up? And then you have to analyze all that. And then you have to do another draft. And it's just sort of a process of raking through everything. Because I think our minds are very chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get something that feels elegant and refined, it takes a lot of behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just a huge drafting process.
When you do the second draft, do you just rewrite from scratch or do you like revise and like change words or sentences?
I keep them all. So the story I'm working on right now, the document is now 55 pages. And that's mm-hmm. because everything that I'm pushing, I'll cut and paste and I'll push everything down to the bottom and then I start over.
I call it the parking lot.
Yeah, I put it in the parking lot. Yeah, so, and I do rewrites, and I've actually just started dropping the word revision.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rewrite.
Right.
And I think that's how I became a better writer. When I was younger, I would just write one draft, and I was like, it's amazing, right? New Yorker, call me up. But, like, that did not happen.
So are you talking about the novel? You've mentioned the novel.
Yeah.
But usually I'd never, ever ask, like, what's next? Because people are like,
but I got one. Okay.
So tell me about it.
The novel is my original story that I wanted to tell. Before I wrote these stories, I always wanted to tell the story of my family coming up to Denver from Southern Colorado. It's our migration story, essentially. So it's set in the 1890s and then in the 1930s. And the 1890s section follows a family and a Mexican sharpshooter named Simodicia. And the second grouping of people in the 1930s follows a young clairvoyant girl named Luce. And she's a tea leaf reader, and she's based off my Auntie Lucy. And her brother, Diego, he's a snake charmer, and he works at a factory. and that's all. I'm going to tell you about the characters. I don't talk about plot, just characters.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but I've turned it in. I'm working on my edits, and it's just so thrilling to be able to like live my life making books.
Yeah.
Like, I always wanted this, so thank you guys. This is so cool.
I wanted to ask you about your one brother.
Yeah.
Because that sounds rough.
Well, oh my gosh. He's so lucky.
It was a very quick question. I mostly just wanted to be like, yeah. I wanted to acknowledge that he was like one of seven.
He read the book.
And did he like the book?
He was like, yo, like, there's some mean white guys in this book. He was like, his one comment. And then, yeah, he like honed in on one weird little remark about a girl's knees in Sabrina and Karina. And he was like, did she? And I was like, so yeah, my brother, everybody.
Well, I'm glad he liked it. Did he feel like he understood you better after reading it?
He did. I think he did, but I also understood him
better. For all of you, all six of you?
Well, he was just such a close reader that I couldn't believe, like, he's paying attention to us mm-hmm. in a way. I thought he was just, like, going to hockey practice and, like, smelling weird.
Yeah.
I heard that girls think their brothers stink as, like, an evolutionary tactic to keep, yeah. But I think, yeah.
What's been the hardest thing about this book, about publishing it? Having it in the world,
yeah.
writing it, whatever it is, whatever.
I think now it's learning to let go of my child, my, mm-hmm. my book child. I really wanted to be able to control everything. Like, I picked my cover, and when I couldn't get any press coverage or reviews, I hit the road, and I put together my own tour, and I did all this stuff. But now I'm kind of like, I have to still create art. Like, yeah. I can't just control Sabrina and Karina. She has to go to college now.
Right.
So, goodbye.
And what's the best part of the publication of this book, besides becoming a writer?
Yeah,
and,
oh,
like,
I
being
love
published
it.
And being able to hold it. So you can't say, I have a book, my name's on it. But, like, the best thing about it being in the world.
People. I love, like, meeting so many people. And I love having readers. Like, I want to cry. But, yeah, just people and, like, their stories and what they share with me and the things that they tell me. And I felt so alone my whole life. And mm-hmm. to know that there's so many people like me, that's yeah. just been such a beautiful experience.
Well, I think that is probably a good moment to clap. But also to move it to Q&A from the audience. So I think there's going to be some mics that are passing around. And they will come to you. I'm not pointing and doing the thing.
Just wanting to learn about your culture, and I hadn't thought about if you were already here, maybe the literature had missed you, which was interesting. And you mentioned something that happened to your ancestors, which were they were robbed of their language, and not just Spanish, but their indigenous language. And I know in some cultures they sent kids away to schools where they weren't allowed to teach. And was that the experience here? Or what was the mechanism that robbed them of their language? And do you think it was a concerted effort, or is it just something that happened as a course of not being the dominant, you know, part of society?
Well, I think it's white supremacy is what happened. No, I mean, I mean, I can give you like examples. Yeah, the boarding schools that like my great grandmother's brothers were put into, and just being put into public education where you were beat for speaking Spanish. Those kinds of things happened. People in my family were told not to go by their real names, to change their names so they would sound more American. But yeah, I mean, it's a long process, and it's in the air. It's just something that was in the air in the Southwest. And one of the ways that I saw it most clearly defined, when I would go down to New Mexico to do research, the archives were just flushed with information. And then as soon as you go over the Colorado border, nothing. I mean, there were some in the San Luis Valley where some of my ancestors come from. And I do wonder what was happening in Colorado. So Colorado was also controlled by the Ku Klux Klan for many decades, off and on, primarily in the 1920s, they were huge. And some other just strange things that happened, Colorado sent, I don't know if it's the National Guard, but they sent somebody to go down to protect the border between New Mexico and Colorado to keep New Mexicans out. So, I mean, yeah, there's just all these little examples throughout history, and the next book will show you why. Okay, thank you for your question.
Hey. Your cover art, it just looks really symbolic. Can you kind of explain
yeah.
it to us?
Yeah, I'd love to. So the way I found my cover is really interesting. My friend's a makeup artist, and she brought me over to her apartment at like 10 o'clock in the morning and was doing my makeup, and she and her boyfriend were like getting really stoned off dabs. And I was like, okay, I have to tell that part of the story because it just sets the mood. Because it was like, so I'm like looking across, trying like to be away from the dab smoke because that's lethal. And I see like a print on the wall, and I had been given really terrible covers. And so I was on the hunt for like anything. And I said, who did that? Who did that? And my friend goes, Gustavo Rimada. You don't know who that is? And I was like, no. But I said, he will do my cover. I felt it in that moment. And then I brought his work to Random House like the next day. And I said, I want him to do it. And they, it's called Mother of the Land is the name of the print. And I think Gustavo, he designed this like separate. And then they kind of just, I feel like it just merged so perfectly with the stories. So I don't know about the symbolism that he put into it, but from my own personal experience, like one of the things that I have in my family that's been inherited through my ancestors are poppies, because we would keep seeds and we would replant. So like the fact that she's flanked by the poppies, I feel is like so strong and such a beautiful, just like secret nod I have to my great grandma and her exposed heart. I do think is it also speaks to the stories. Yeah, but his work is so beautiful. Thank you for your question.
Someone over here. Hi.
Hi.
Girl, I have like 40 million questions for you, but I'm gonna narrow it down. But just a quick comment on how serendipitous it is that Gustavo did your cover and that it was, so you brought up makeup. Right? So
yeah.
Have you seen like the Melt Cosmetics
Amor Eterno
collection?
Yeah.
I bought that because I love his artwork too. And so he designed now this, like the cover for this makeup collection, sidebar. But I wanna ask you again about, you mentioned how there can be beauty in pain.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that is so present in Latinidad, in the hybridity, right, of our multi-layered, multi-racial, obviously like very indigenous Latinx experience. And it's almost like this, it's like this bittersweetness. Like there is a beauty, there's a joy in feeling pain. And you can see it in mariachi music,
yeah,
et cetera. And it also maybe explains like why we like the Smiths or Morrissey or like emo too. So I guess I'm excited to hear you like talk about that more and how that can be cathartic, how that can be healing or, you know, et cetera.
Thank you for that question. I think when I, like if I were to give like a one sentence speech about my book, it's like there is beauty in the struggle. I think it does, it comes from growing up in a culture that death is not something we were ever afraid of. Death, I mean, everybody is afraid to die on some level, but I think death was something that was just part of my life. I have a huge family, so elders were dying as babies were being born. So I'm going to baptisms at the same time that I'm going to funerals and I'm being forced to kiss dead bodies. So I think it was so much a part of my life, but it was always, there was such reverence for the dead. And people, I have memories of some of my ancestors that I did not meet. They are dead. They have been dead for generations. But I feel as if I know them. And the only reason I know them is because when they died, their stories were then immortalized in the family. And they were told as these larger-than-life characters and these figures. I still haven't quite figured out what it is that draws me so strongly to death, but I do think it has to do with our indigenous roots and coming from the homeland and just being ingrained in that life cycle of we're continuous beings. Like I when I die, that's not like it's gonna keep rippling out in my family. That's just how it works. And so I think that the connection to death and the connection to life and the beauty is that is where like the soul of humanity comes from. And that's a really deep, really weird answer. But thank you for that. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
There's been so much controversy about the book American Dirt, and many Latina writers have been asked to weigh in. And I'm wondering if you were asked to weigh in publicly, and you talked about your experience in 7 years to break through in the publishing industry. And I'm wondering if the controversy might work in your favor in getting publishers to, or in the work in the favor of Latino and Latina writers in the future.
We sort of decided, we talked a little bit earlier, and I think the American Dirt Road kind of just takes away from talking about your work. I mean, I know that there's a lot of relevance, and if you want to answer it, it's cool, but I just sort of said that I would intervene, that I think like it's just better to talk about Karina and Sabrina and Kali's work than to talk about, you know. So if you'd like to answer, that's up to you, but it's like, but we sort of, I said that I would.
I think we've read a lot of takes, and I think a lot of us are like, we just read a lot of takes at this point. So if you want to ask me privately, I'll talk to you privately about it. But thanks for your question.
Hi. First off, can I say Lisa's asking some great questions? Like, awesome.
Well, I can hear it. I can hear you.
Like, I go to a lot of Q&As, and Lisa's asking some great questions.
So. Oh, okay.
Okay, thanks. And I read, like, Sabrina and Karina is the first book I finished this year. And I just wanted to ask, like, there's a lot of mix in the music and, like, the art throughout the stories. And how does that mixture of music, especially during Sisters, there's a lot of, like, music playing in the background. How does music or, like, those aspects of the Latinx culture helped you in your process of writing? Especially Sisters.
Oh, I love that question. I love that you read this book. It's the first one you finished. I hope you finish many more this year. So again, like going off the idea about like beauty and pain. So the elders in my family, they would listen to these sad, sad songs all the time. And they would like bake pies and like, you know, cook chili and like be sad. So I should get a t-shirt. But one of the things that does help me get into that melancholic sort of atmosphere is to play some of the songs. So, like, you'll notice there's a lot of Patsy Cline in Sisters. That is directly comes from, like, listening to my great-grandmother and her sisters, like, talk about Patsy Cline, how much they loved her sad, sad life, you know. So I do think that whatever taps into your emotional core that allows you to experience that world and that atmosphere, sometimes music is like a shortcut to be able to turn it back on so you can get back into it when you're working on writing. So I have playlists that I write to, but I also get really obsessed with like a couple songs and I'll play them before, like a warm-up song, like at the gym. But I'm like, now we're gonna get sad, okay? And then when I actually write, it's like dead silence and I'm just like the worst posture ever. But yeah, and there's like Neil Young and there's Bob Dylan and there's a lot of different music. So I really appreciate you noticing that. Thank you.
Hi. Something I really loved about your stories and Erica's stories is that you really see all these different generations of a family. And I recently went on a trip with my grandmother back to Mexico, and that in itself and reading Sabrina and Karina became just like its own revelation of just my grandmother is a woman and a person all in of herself. And she's not just my grandmother. And so getting to read these stories and realize that everybody is just a person. It's not just what they are in relation to me. So for you, is it easier, you know, writing about your older generations or about somebody who's, contemporary to you? I'm really interested just in that.
That is one of the most beautiful things someone's ever said to me, that like you, that your grandma's a full person now. I love it. It's so cool. So when I was working on the older generation for the draft of the novel, I was like, these people had sex. Like, I was like sitting there trying to write these like love scenes like on about this character based on my great grandmother, and I was like, what? Wait. Like, she said that, like, they didn't sleep together until after the wedding. But I was like, but here they are in this scene, and I know they're about to do it. So I think just, like, knowing that they had their inner lives, their engines firing as much as we do, and it doesn't matter what time period it is. And, maybe they didn't do those things because of the social mores at the time. But definitely when I'm working on them, I'm like, they're a little bit wilder than they actually let on, I think. So. Thank you for that question.
Hi, Callie.
Hi.
I'm a little bit nervous, but I actually have a question for you.
Throughout the research, have you gotten closer to your family? Because I find that as I get older, I find more stories out from my mom and her friends. And I feel like I've gotten to know her much more than I did when I was younger. Yeah. Has that been the experience for you as well?
Yeah. My mom, Lisa actually met my mom at the National Book Awards.
She's the actual best. She gave someone in my office a rose. Like, literally the most charming person.
Oh, thank you. I was like, come on, mom, keep it together. Yeah, so my mom and I really butt heads throughout my upbringing, and I think it's because we're a lot alike, but there's also, you've read the book, there's some issues going on, but one of the things that we've really, like, connected over was our shared interest in our genealogy and that research, and she'll like, find something out about, like, an ancestor from, like, the 1700s who came from Spain or some, like, lie, but anyway, like, whatever, but, yeah, we get to have this conversation now and share about that. And like you were saying, like before, my mom was just my mom. She was only the person that was supposed to take care of me, and everything else about her life I didn't care about. And now I'm realizing that this person had, like, she's a full human being. And with her accessing her history, it allows me to access my history more deeply. And if, you know, the next generation in my family, they're going to even be able to access it further. So it's so nice to be able to give that kind of context back. But I love that you feel closer. That's so cool. Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. So thank you all so much for being here, and a huge
round
of applause for Kali.
Thank you.
She is going to be signing books. I encourage you to pick it up and read it if you haven't yet, because it's incredible. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you all for coming.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.